The Overwhelmed Brain is brought to you by decades of dysfunction, years of healing, and the ability to admit that I'm not done yet. Are you annoyed by affirmations? How about 150 episodes of The Overwhelmed Brain making fun of the statement, "Think positively and all your sadness will disappear"? You pay for therapy? Just tell your brain to be happy. It's that easy. Well, gotta go. Enjoy the show. If affirmations feel like lies and positive thinking feels like denial, then get ready to start creating the life you've always wanted now. That's right, it's 150 episodes of The Overwhelmed Brain, and we're not stopping anytime soon. This is Paul Pugliani, personal empowerment coach and host of this show called The Overwhelmed Brain, the personal growth show for the critical thinker. On every episode, we'll talk about practical down-to-earth steps to help you improve your mood and keep you sane in this powerful journey we call life. I want to help you bridge the gap between your emotions and reason, causing you to discover why you do the things you do and what you can do to reach higher levels of happiness and lower levels of stress and overwhelm. And if you're here to learn more common sense tips for improving your life, that train already left, so you're stuck on the one that teaches uncommon sense. But that's even better, because the destination is where you're going to learn, heal, grow, and evolve. Well, we're at episode 150, and not that it matters to you. You don't pay attention to the episode numbers, but I do, because they're little milestones, and they're a gauge of when I started and how long I've been doing this and what changes have taken place. I like to look at the life of the overwhelmed brain about every 50 episodes or so, and see which direction it's going and see how it's going and what I think of it and the messages that I get from you and what you think about it. And so far, so good. Everything is going well. In the past 250 episode points, I made some changes, and I thought, what kind of changes should I make now? And I don't think there's any changes to be made. I mean, unless you disagree, but I think the way the show is going now seems to be better than it's ever been. I mean, you probably miss the old music intros like I do. But those probably won't come back, so sorry about that. But we don't need to think about that, because it's always about forward momentum. And I want to talk about myself for a few minutes. I never do that, right? No, I do that a lot. I do that quite a bit on this show because I'm always sharing a story that has something to do with perhaps someone who wrote a letter and said they're going through something. And if I can relate to it, I'll certainly share what I went through and how I was able to get through it or not and heal from it, or am still healing from it, or haven't healed from it yet because I haven't discovered it about myself yet. There's all kinds of possibilities here. But I want to talk about a struggle and a success of doing this show, because a lot of people don't know the history behind The Overwhelmed Brain, and probably a lot of people don't care, but this is episode 150, so I get to be a little bit more freeform on this episode because it's a milestone, like I said, and I am happy to be here serving you. It sounds a little weird, but I feel like I serve you because I come on the air every week, and there isn't a boss above me paying me for this. I just do it because I know what I know, and I want to share what I know. And one of the reasons I started this show is because I was able to help people. Like when I was working 9 to 5, I would stay after, I would help my coworkers because they would share stories, and I would say things and their eyes would get wide and they would go, "Wow, I never thought of it like that." And I thought, why am I only telling one person at a time? And I thought, wow, people get a lot from what I say. So why don't I just put it out there? Because if it's helping one person at work, maybe it'll help 100 people in the world. Maybe it'll help 1,000. Maybe it'll help 10,000. And maybe it'll go on to help even more. I mean, what if what I know isn't known by a lot of people? And if their life could change, why wouldn't I put it out there somehow? And, you know, what I first started doing was blogging. All right, I'll buy the domain name, theoverwhelmedbrain.com. I can't believe it's available. But I bought it, and then I just put out my first blog article. And, of course, no one knew about the site, and I didn't know how to put it out there, so I just started writing. This is what I know. This is how you can resolve this in your life, heal from this in your life, get over this in your life, or this is a perspective that I have. And of course, if you've ever done this, if you've ever put out a blog article, not the world doesn't flock to it. No one comes to the blog unless you start talking about it with other people. So I get on Facebook, I get on Twitter, and then I start meeting all these other bloggers. And then I start meeting other podcasters, and they're telling me how they're getting the message out and what they're doing to spread their teachings and what they do. I mean, and there's all kinds of teachings that people have. So I started listening to these people, and they said, you need to get on Instagram and Clout and LinkedIn, and there's a ton more of these social sharing sites, social media sites, business networking sites. There's just tons of them out there. And I was like, okay, I'll do all that. I'll spread the message. I'll spread the word. That way everybody can hear what I have to say. It sounds a little egoistic, but I really wanted to spread this message out there because if one person is learning and healing from what I know, then maybe more could heal and grow and learn and evolve and all this stuff that I say now. And I really wanted that out there because I used to be in a place that quite frankly sucked. I used to be depressed. I have had thoughts of suicide. I have been a people pleaser. I grew up in an alcoholic household. I have been abused, not to the extent of many of the people that have written to me. So I'm grateful for that. But it messed up my mind and it messed up my relationships because I took false beliefs from my childhood into the world. And I went into my relationships from a place of fear. And then I made decisions from a place of fear. And fear controlled my life. And it wasn't until my mid-30s where I had pretty much a breakdown, where I collapsed on my knees and I was crying in front of the woman who eventually would become my wife and then my ex-wife, and so on and so on. If you've been listening to this show, you understand, you know the stories. But after that was the start of my healing from a lot of this stuff. Holding on to anger and hate that I didn't even know was in there. And what do I do with it? And how can I get it out? How can I heal from it? I started reading a lot and learning a lot. And then I started taking leaps of faith. Like, what would happen if I said this to this person? What would happen if I did this where it's scary, but I'll do it anyway? And I started learning about myself and learning about what my boundaries are and what my limitations are and how to expand and go beyond my limitations and honor my boundaries and so on and so forth. So all of this, I just had to put out there because I learned about it. And then, of course, I started studying about psychology and brain sciences, and I got into hypnosis and something called NLP and learning how people communicate and how I communicate, and then becoming very self-observant, like what I'm doing in the moment, instead of just being unconscious in the moment, being very conscious of my behavior. Like, why do I do that? Why do I think that? Why do I feel that? Became very curious, became my own coach or therapist or whatever you want to call it, and started asking myself questions. And I think that's what self-help is all about, is being very curious and becoming very critically minded. You know, critical thinking. You start thinking deeper on a deeper level about, I really want to know why this is the way it is. I really want to know why I'm that way. I was once a manipulative person. I want to know why I'm manipulative. I want to know what I do to manipulate situations or people. So I figured that out and I stopped being so judgmental and on and on and on and on. I could just just keep stringing this along. But the whole point is I had all this knowledge and I wanted to put it out there, created my blog, talked to other bloggers, talked to other podcasters, and then finally decided, you know what? I need to create a podcast. And I joined a group with other podcasters that would help me start this thing up. And at the time, I didn't have a clue what to do. I got to start a podcast? What does that mean? Does that mean I have to buy a microphone? Well, yes, but you also have to buy a couple $1,000s of other equipment too. That's not necessarily true, but I chose to make it a high quality show. So I bought a bunch of equipment and started talking on the air. And suddenly I was a podcaster. Suddenly I am a coach that teaches through podcasting as a means of communicating to you and get you to a place where you're empowered so that you can make the right decisions for you. And I feel pretty good about that because if you're empowered, then I've succeeded in my original mission, which I didn't even know it was my mission the first day I started The Overwhelmed Brain. I just knew that I was helping my coworkers and they left empowered, being able to make the right decision for them. And sometimes they did and sometimes they didn't. Meaning, sometimes we know the right decision to make and we still don't make it because we're afraid. And you know, that's probably what stops a lot of us, including myself sometimes, is that we have this fear that stops us from saying what we want to say or doing what we want to do, and we don't get anywhere. We stay in a rut. We stay in stagnation, and that's not power. How do we become empowered? We take steps forward. We need momentum. And the only way to get momentum is to take that first step, to create the momentum. I always say at the end of the show, step into your power. All that is step one. You take step one toward what you want for yourself, and that creates power. It really does. And then power creates momentum. Momentum creates change. Change creates confidence in you to take the next step. And then once you take the next step, it recycles. And then you get power, and then momentum, and then change. And then soon you feel good enough that you don't have to think about it anymore and it just becomes you. Meaning if you had trouble honoring your personal boundaries before and you had to go through this process of taking a baby step and a leap of faith sometimes into doing what you want to do or saying what you want to say, then you practice honoring your personal boundaries over and over again. It doesn't become a thought process anymore. It gets beyond thought. Because you get so good at doing it, it's just a no-brainer, I guess you could call it. It's something you don't have to think about because it's automatic. I'm automatically going to honor myself. I don't have to think about how to do it. I already know how to do it. It's just going to happen. And then the fear is gone. And once the fear is gone, you're there. You already know how to do it. So you work on something else in yourself. Because once you have personal boundaries down, a lot of life becomes a lot easier. You get a lot of your power back and you can do almost anything you want. Almost. So I wanted to talk about a little bit of a struggle that I dealt with just to be a little bit vulnerable to you and tell you what I had to do to, after I got divorced, how do I build this up so it's not only sustainable, but I can start enjoying life while giving. Because, I mean, this is the people pleaser that I used to be and is probably somewhat still in me, is that I really love to give because it makes me feel good. And that small people pleaser part of me says, I don't need anything in return. And when you do that, then you start going into deficit, emotional deficit, sometimes monetary deficit, whatever deficit it is, it's happening when you are the one that gives and gives and gives and doesn't want to get back. That's not how energy is created. That's not how power is created. Power is created when you give and get something in return. Now, let me explain that so it doesn't sound like a selfish thing. For example, when you give your time to help someone move, like move furniture, and it's a lot of hard work, and they're grateful, and they thank you, and maybe they feed you pizza too, and you feel like, wow, they're so grateful, and that made me feel so good, that is a return. Someone being grateful is a return. However, if you help them move, and they were grateful, and they said thank you, and they gave you pizza, but you didn't feel like it was enough, now you're in deficit. Sure, a lot of people would say, well, you're helping a friend. You should be fine with that. But if you're one of those people pleasers that gives and gives and gives, and every time you give, you start to bring lack into your own life, you're going to find that everything you do when you give, there'll never be enough getting back. It just feels like you're getting more and more into your own emotional deficit. So even when someone says, thank you so much for helping me move, you're like, oh, of course, you're welcome, of course. And then you go home and you feel resentful. You feel like, I don't know why I said yes. And then you hold on to that resentment and you're in emotional deficit. You don't have enough coming back into your life. And all that means is that you're probably not taking care of yourself. And you're saying yes to too many people for things that you really don't want to do or have in your life. And so what do? You have to take care of yourself. Those are your personal boundaries. You have to understand what is too much for you and start taking care of you first. Because you know what's going to happen is those same people are going to call you again thinking that you enjoyed it. And they're going to say, hey, we have something else we would love for you to help us with. And you're going to be like, oh, of course I'll come, of course. And then you'll build more resentment and more resentment. So I think it's very important to understand when you're putting yourself into deficit, if you're one of those people pleasers. I was for a long time. And even though at the beginning I was doing this show and getting a lot out of it and meeting a lot of good people, there was no financial return. So it would be great to continue doing it for free, but you can't sustain it. So what I had to do was figure out how I could sustain it and still do what I want to do, still give by creating the show. So that's why I had to come out with like the donate button, and I had to become an Amazon affiliate. So when you shop at Amazon, it helps the show. And of course, I created the TOB Patron program, and that gives back to the show. And finally, my main business model, which is coaching. If people didn't pay for coaching, you know, the show couldn't go on. If people didn't use the Amazon link, the show couldn't go on. The Patron program, the show doesn't go on. So on and so forth. All these things bring this show to you. So there's a little bit about me. There's a little bit about the show. And some of the business model, not that you care, but yeah, you might be curious of what I do and how I do things and how I make this show keep going on. And of course, I didn't mention like sometimes we'll get sponsors for the show. We talk about Asha with Get Out of the Mess. We've had Casper.com, and we've even had Audible.com, and who else? We've had AwayTravel.com with their travel luggage, and different entities throughout time have helped bring this show to you. So if you ever hear a sponsor, remember they're helping bring this show to you. And if you like this show, then support them too. And the fact that you're listening and maybe even spreading the word about the show is also a method of supporting the show, because the more people that hear it, the more people that listen, then the more, in my opinion, the more the world gets better. I mean, if there are people suffering that you know could benefit from this show, definitely share it. There's probably one episode that could change someone's life. Not because I'm all that. It's because of the information. Sometimes you hear the right information in the right way, and it changes everything. And that's what I want. That's what I want for you. I want you to be able to change your life. If it's not going well, then let's find a way to make it go better. Let's find a way to get through some of the hard stuff so that you can have a better life going forward. And who knows, maybe you're having the best life ever and you just like listening to the sound of my voice. Well, if that's the case, then keep listening then, because we're going to go on to our next segment called Ask Paul, and we'll see where it takes us. Thanks for letting me be a little bit open, a little bit vulnerable, and for letting me and my life dominate the first segment of this episode. Hey, it's 150. I always do something a little different every 50 episodes, and that was a little different. Ask Paul coming up right now. Okay, I'm not sure how I feel about that transition music because it sounds like the end of one of my Minutes to Momentum episodes. But it's inspiring music, so I like to have it in there just for this special episode number 150. So here we are at the Ask Paul segment. This is where I read a listener email on the air and do my best to address their challenge. This letter is a long one that I am going to shorten because it has a lot of information in there. But I'm going to just highlight the important points that I want to address, and let's see where we go with it. Hi, Paul. First, thank you for your podcast. I'm writing to you because I'm starting to get confused about myself. I don't know what is wrong with me. I just can't create nor maintain new acquaintances. I desire to be more social, but I never succeed in this. And because I've shortened this, I'm going to fill in some gaps here. He starts talking about his family and how it's strange for, and I'll keep reading, it's strange for me to use the word family because it was more like four strangers sharing the same apartment. Those four strangers being myself, my brother, my mother, and my father. My father is very tyrannic and autocratic towards other members. There was constant critic coming from him, and he behaved like he owned us, like he was the king, and others existed just to improve his life quality. Relations between my parents were mostly bad. Father always criticized my mother over small things. There were times when they were good, but they were particularly hard for me and my brother, because usually mother was on our side, but to maintain good relations, she also turned her back on my brother and I. Now I find it pathetic that a grown-up woman can't stand up for herself. It was always my mother's strategy to blame my father, but she never did anything to get things better. Neither my mother nor my father cared much about me or my brother. We were more like a nuisance to them. And they rarely spent money on us. They tried to save on their children, even though they spent on themselves all the time. I remember overhearing a discussion between them where they talked about how much money they have in their bank accounts. Both had tens of thousands of dollars, yet I still had to lie in school that I was sick when I actually had no skis to participate on school's skiing days. In the past, I was diagnosed with severe depression, social phobia, an overly type A personality with OCD traits, for which I take medication to this day. In hindsight, I remember also having a lot of suicidal thoughts. My type A personality was probably caused because of my non-caring parents, because as a child, I naturally tried to impress them. I am a quintessential introvert, and I need private time. I have so many people to deal with at work that it almost kills my motivation for social relations outside of work. Anyway, in university, my perfectionism ended with severe depression. I received medication and cognitive behavioral therapy, and I feel a lot better, but I'm still, let's say, very melancholic. Now I'm 28. I've never had any serious relationships. I don't have any friends, and last time I had friends was about in 2002. Every day is the same for me. I wake up, go to work. After work, on my free time, I study, go swimming, watch TV, play a video game, or read something. The only people I deal with are my patients and colleagues. Sometimes, about once a month, my mother calls me, conversations last about 30 seconds, and they're always the same. Always in my free time, I'm completely alone. Only reason I have to talk on weekends is to say hi to a shop clerk. I don't even know where to meet people. One could copy one day of my life and paste it to every day in my future, and no one would know the difference. And it makes me sad because I want to be more social. My shrink said that I have to be more social. I would love to, but how? Now I think I'm over the worst part of my social anxiety, but it feels like I don't have the social skills anymore. I feel like I just don't have anything to talk about with new people. I met someone recently on a dating website. We went to a restaurant, and a huge part of our meal was that awkward silence. I don't know how to talk to people, and people don't know what to talk to me about. Every time I meet new friends, it ends up with a failure. I also feel very boring as a person. Now at work, my patients and I have a very specific topic to discuss, and when we're ready, the patient leaves and there's no awkward silence. And they often thank me for being so friendly with them. Also, nurses and colleagues at work seem to like me as a professional and as a person. However, I often see people's smiles fade and they slightly frown when they talk to me. However, when talking casually with people, I always manage to say something that ends the conversation completely. I can even watch their smile fade into a frown. I feel that they don't get me, or I don't even know what makes them frown, honestly. When I'm with two or more people, those two talk to each other and I'm completely left out. I just can't join the conversation. I just don't know what to say. Even at work where I feel comfortable, I sometimes freeze when someone starts to ask me about where I'm from or wants to know more about my country. I tend to answer with one word and find a way to quickly resume our professional talk. I answer with one word because I need time to think my answer through. Not because I have to talk in a foreign language or anything, but because I just don't know what to say. After we part, I often think about how I should have answered. My shrink once said that I lack spontaneity. I have a huge problem with small talk. I just can't do it. And all of this makes me wonder what's wrong with me. Why can't I connect with other people like a normal person? I'm educated, economically well-off, and a good-hearted person. Why can't I find or maintain acquaintances? I lack closeness with someone. I suspect that my childhood plays a major role in my problems, but I'm an independent man now. How can I get rid of this baggage? At this point, I'm not even sure anymore that my problem is mental health. Maybe I just lack the skills to communicate with people. Can you recommend a book or something that improves communication skills? Or can you or someone help me? If my life continues unchanged, I'll never have any friends, nor a wife, nor a family of my own. Thank you for reading my long letter, Bill. Okay, Bill, thank you so much for sharing that. And that's not your real name. I'm using that name so no one identifies you, who you are, where you work, and things like that, because I want to protect your anonymity here. However, I'm going to answer right off something that I noticed about you. And it's, you know, all I can see is what you wrote and how you wrote and what you said. So these are mainly assumptions. But first things first is that you said that you're not very good at small talk. Now, you wrote one of the longest letters I've ever received. And now I'm not putting you down for that. What I'm saying is that you have a lot to talk about. You have a lot inside of you to talk about. You have a lot to express. My thought is that you choose not to express the things that are really on your mind. Because you poured your thoughts out into an email to me, and you talked about a lot of stuff. You talked about your family. You talked about your work. I'm going to say it again. You have a lot to talk about. It's what you choose not to talk about, which is why you have those awkward silences. Now, why do you have that awkward silence in any conversation that you have? Is it because you don't want people to see you as any less than you are? Because you had an upbringing that maybe you didn't feel worthy enough or significant enough, and that you needed to impress your dad or your mom or whoever? Is it because you feel like if you say the wrong thing that someone's going to look down on you? Like you said, their smile fades into a frown. And my assumption is that yes. Yes, I think that when you open your mouth, you're thinking, what are they going to think of me? I mean, you immediately go outside your head, or actually you're in your head, but you're examining your environment and you're examining people's behaviors and reactions to what you're doing. In fact, several times in this email, you said, I'm waiting for their response. I'm watching, like I said, their smile fade. I'm listening to what they say. I can tell they're not interested. Everything is externally focused. I'm focused on them while I talk. A lot of people don't do that. A lot of people with anxiety do that. I'm glad you're over your social anxiety, because part of social anxiety or any anxiety is being worried about what other people think or might think, or being worried what someone might say or do because of something that you said or did. Anxiety builds up when we're so focused outside of us on what other people think, and we just make this stuff up too. We make up what they're thinking when we're talking. And I've come to find that most people think about the same things, especially in group situations. Most people think, I wonder what they're going to think of me. Some people are anxious about it. I wonder what they're going to think of me. If they think this, they're going to think less of me. If they think that, I don't know what to think. What's going to happen if they think that? And other people go, if they like me, great. If not, well, I tried. Some people get anxious about it. Some people don't. So first things first, where is your energy when you're in a conversation with anyone? If your energy, and all I mean is that wherever you're putting your attention, if all of that is in how they respond, then what you're doing inside of you is calculating what the best behavior is for them. And what I mean by that is that if you go inside and calculate how you should behave, what you should say, then what you're going to do is create a lot of stress on yourself, first of all. Secondly, you're not going to be honest. You're going to say things that you think they want to hear and say things that you think will impress them about you. Or even if you're not into impressing people, you may still have something in there that says, I can't look bad. I can't look weak. I can't be vulnerable. And that's who you need to be if you plan on connecting with anyone. You know, I think about that scene you described in a restaurant when you're on this date and you have this awkward silence. Who hasn't been in that awkward silence? And it's because there's inner dialogue going on in probably both of you, usually, where you're thinking, geez, I don't know what to say. I mean, think about yourself. I don't know what to say. This is awkward. I guarantee you she's thinking the same thing. I don't know what to say. This is awkward. So what better conversation to have than to say, I feel so awkward. I don't know what to say. You know what's going to happen? She's going to go, oh, I'm so glad you said that. Me too. And then you'll laugh and then the ice breaks and then you're fine. And then the conversation can go on from there. That's called addressing what's happening in the moment. This is what I've talked about before with anxiety. When you walk into a room and you have anxiety, you find someone to address this anxiety with. You go up and say, wow, I'm feeling really anxious in this room and I don't know why. And they're like, oh, you know, what's going on? And I don't know. I just feel this anxiety building up. And then they'll say, oh my God, you know, tell me more. Or they'll say something. I mean, this doesn't always work for anxiety. There's forms of anxiety that may not work for, but just addressing it, just letting it go, letting it out, eases the tension, takes off the pressure. You're putting a lot of pressure on yourself. You are so wrapped up in your head and seeing you from other people's eyes that you're losing connection with yourself. This isn't about connecting with other people. This is about connecting with you and being that authentic you without fear. I don't know, maybe you think that you have a status to uphold or a position or a reputation to uphold. And I tell you what, everyone has vulnerabilities. Everyone has weaknesses or things that they don't have strength in. Everyone has characteristics about them that some people are going to find favorable and some people aren't. This is the wonderful thing about talking with other people, is that you don't talk to continually try to impress them. You talk to share with them. Share with them who you really are. Your fears, your worries, your concerns, and your joys and the things that you've succeeded in life or not. But these are the things that come up that it's okay to talk about, even at the risk of being judged. Because what happens is, most people tend not to judge people who are vulnerable. Most people tend to judge people who are not vulnerable, who try to impress. I mean, I may be way off here, but think about this for a second. Let's just say you have two people standing in front of you, and one of them says, "Well, I graduated with honors at my college, and I speak on stage every week to a room full of CEOs," and they go on and on and on, "and I own a Mercedes and a Ferrari and a mansion in Maui and a mansion in Hawaii and a mansion in California." I mean, they go on and on and on. There's nothing wrong with any of that, but you can tell there's a little bit of, "I'm all that. I am superior." You could just hear it in the inflection of his voice. It may not be true, but this is what you're sensing. So you make a judgment and you go, "Wow, that guy's arrogant," or "that guy's pretentious," or "that guy thinks he's better than me." You just have all these judgments that come up. And then you have the other person, man or woman, it doesn't matter. I can only do man's voices. So, so this other person goes, "Last week, my son got a D in math. I was so embarrassed. And then the day after that, he was sick. And I got mad at him because I thought he was faking it. So I disciplined him and grounded him. And then we went to the doctor and I found out that he really was sick. And then I felt like a fool. I felt like an idiot. You know, I thought I was a good dad. And now I feel like I'm a really terrible father." Now, what happens then? Are you judging this person? Are you judging this person for telling the truth of his weaknesses, his vulnerabilities? I mean, when I hear myself say that, I go, "This poor guy, he's admitting to me that he has faults. Wow." Who are you more likely to trust? Who are you more likely to connect with? The person who tries to impress you, or the person who shows where he is most vulnerable? And this is what I mean, is that one person is outside himself trying to make the world see him as in a certain light, and the other person is inside himself going, "You know what? I have my faults, and I'm not afraid to admit it. I'm not afraid to be honest, and whatever the world wants to say about me, they can say." And so many people think that when we admit our faults, when we admit that we are, quote, inferior in some way, that we have done bad behavior or we're not proud of something that we did, we think that the world's going to judge us, but quite the opposite happens. Most people will connect with the vulnerable person, with the honest person, even when they do things that we don't agree with. Like, "I can't believe he would discipline his son for being sick. But you know, I've made mistakes too, and I've assumed things and have been wrong as well." Because that's what this does, is that it opens up our own vulnerabilities when we're vulnerable with other people. And then those awkward silences disappear. Not all the time, because some people aren't comfortable being vulnerable, but they get more comfortable if you are. And if they still aren't comfortable and they still can't open up, then they're just not ready. They're not ready for that type of communication. And that's fine. That's quite all right. But think about the communication style that you have today. At work, sure, it's easy. You can talk to your patients and you know what to tell them because you've been studying this stuff and you know how to communicate what you're telling them, and you're in control. It's easy for you to be in control in this situation. Outside of work or with colleagues and friends or things like that, everything's a wild card. You aren't in control and anything could happen. And that puts the fear of death in some people. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but sometimes it feels that way. They fear being themselves because of what someone might think, say, or do when they find out who you really are or what you've really done in your life. So Bill, it's not really about trying to make friends or keep friends or trying to get past these awkward silences. It's connecting within, going, "What am I thinking right now? What am I feeling right now?" And then asking yourself the question, If I knew that the person I was with would absolutely not judge me and they were completely safe, what would I say right now? Or what would I do right now? And when it comes up, when you get to a point where I'm not going to fear the consequences and I'm just going to say or do it anyway, then you can start to connect. Because it's really hard to connect from a level of, what's the best way to put it? Fake it till you make it. There are some times when fake it till you make it works. But when you're trying to connect with people and you want a stronger connection than just how's the weather or did you see this movie, if you want a stronger connection than that, then you have to go deeper within yourself and share some of you that you may have been protecting from the world. So that's one of the first things I wanted to tell you, is that it's not so much about connecting with others, it's about connecting with yourself. When you can connect with yourself and have that part of you come out, because that's what maybe you've been fearing letting out, because if we let it out, then somebody might see the real us and they might actually like us or they might not like us. But that's good too, because you want to find out who doesn't like the real you, because you don't want to keep those people in your life. It works out either way. Bring out the real you, find out who likes you. Those who stick around, you're going to have a great, strong bond with. Those who don't, you wouldn't have had it anyway, unless you continued to fake it and then forced a friendship that really wasn't there. So I hope that makes sense. Now, as far as your mom and dad and the way they treated you and what it did to you and what behavior and beliefs that you brought out of that into the adult world, you got to remember that even though they were our parents, they were still people trying to figure out how to survive in the world. They were just regular people with regular dysfunctions that suddenly had a kid. And now they have all these dysfunctions and now there's a kid in the mix. What do we do with this kid? Whether it was planned or not, they are now faced with the fact that they have someone to raise and they barely know how to raise themselves. So, what do you do with that? I mean, we want love and attention and hugs and support and touch and all the right words. We want all these things from our parents because when we're children, those are our primary role models and supporters and caretakers. And that's who we learn from for the most part, unless, you know, our parents weren't there and there was somebody else. But the adults that took care of us, or even some of the children that took care of us, they're a little older than us, hopefully. They are our influence. And we learn a lot. We learn a lot about our self-worth and our significance in life. Are we worthy? And when our parents aren't there in the ways that we need them, we suddenly feel in lack. We suddenly feel less worthy. We sometimes don't feel worthy at all. And that less worthiness turns into low self-esteem and low confidence, and behaviors that are created because we're trying to get that love and attention and support and nurturing and all this stuff. But we're trying to get it from people who are sometimes incapable of giving it. But they're the only ones that we turn to in life. We look to our primary caretakers trying to get that nurturing that we so need and deserve, but they're incapable of doing it. So what do? We look elsewhere for it. We do behavior to try to get it. And then when that behavior doesn't work, we try other behavior. And maybe we find behavior that never works. And maybe we can't ever get their attention in the way we need it. So we grow up in a lack of nurturing. We grow up with feeling neglected, feeling abandoned and rejected. And maybe our social skills aren't that great, because when we communicate, we're still doing that behavior to try to impress the people we meet. We're still trying to impress our parents so we can feel love. We're still trying to get mom or dad's attention in some way by being the person we are when we become an adult. And I probably don't have to tell you that it doesn't work that way. It's not functional. It's not the way we're supposed to treat equal adults. We just don't know how to change that behavior in us. How do I change a behavior that I've had all my life and have no reference to act or behave in any other way? How do I do it? Well, step one, listen to this show. Step two is listen to yourself. Or maybe I should make that step one. Either way, listening to this show is probably a good idea, but listening to yourself is a better idea, because what's inside of you and the things that you really want to say, the things that as a child you felt like you couldn't say or shouldn't say, these things that are sometimes driven by fear, like we have these fears, like if I don't say it the right way, I won't get love, I won't get attention or support or nurturing, you start to say these things. You start to say things without fear of the consequence, knowing that it's inside of you. It's basically saying, what I feel bad about, I am going to talk about. I mean, think about that. What I feel bad about, I'm going to talk about. How does that change me? How does that change my communication style? But if I talk about what I feel bad about, then everyone will want to leave and they'll judge me and they'll think I'm a pathetic mess. That's possible. But that doesn't mean you have to talk about everything with everyone, because you address little things, just like that awkward silence at the dinner table. You address the awkwardness. I feel awkward. You don't have to go, gee, when I was growing up, my parents never paid attention to me, and this feels exactly the same way. That would be even more awkward. You just have to address the immediate feelings and emotions or thoughts in the moment. So when you're in that space of, I feel a little awkward here, you can say that. You could just say, wow, this is so awkward. I'm sorry. I don't really know what to say. We both just met each other, and I don't go on too many dates, so I'm just trying to get used to all this. And you're going to find that it usually breaks the ice and helps you be more comfortable. Because really, that's the next step, is just becoming more comfortable in yourself, in who you are. And all it takes to do that is to get through these baby steps. And I realize some of these baby steps are huge leaps. Because if you weren't that person before, to be that person when you have no reference for it is a leap. It's a leap of faith. Can I do this? Can I survive this? Will they run screaming when I bring out this real person that I am? Probably not. Maybe yes, but probably not. But you need to find out. So the last thing I want to talk about with your letter, Bill, is that you don't need to concentrate on meeting new people. All I want you to do, really, is concentrate on having new experiences. See, right now you're in a rut, and new experiences lead to meeting new people. Who you bring to the experience is how you'll meet people. And what I mean by that is if you go into an experience wanting to meet new people, and there's any type of desperation behind that, you're most likely not going to, well, you could meet people, but not keep those people as friends. Because there's a big difference between enjoying the experience that you're in and someone coming along also enjoying the experience that they're in and then sharing that experience with you. There's that, and then the opposite of you going into an experience hoping to meet someone and then seeing someone and trying to create a friendship with them. And if they sense any type of, I need you, or desperation, I need this person in my life, I hope I get to keep this person as a friend in my life. If that's sensed at all, typically unconsciously, they might get scared. They might back off. And, you know, that could be what's happening. I'm not sure. But that does happen in those types of situations. It's like when I've been single and I wanted a girlfriend, I ended up being the least attractive and the most repulsive person. Not purposefully. It's just that I gave off that vibe. I'm hopefully not the same person now because I've learned a lot about myself. But before, when I was desperate for a partner in life or even a friend to talk to, I gave off that desperate vibe. Because a lot of people don't like that desperate vibe. If you have any type of desperation, then they might be repelled by it. They might not like it. And they may sense it. And if, especially if you put on top of that words that try to impress them or behavior that tries to impress them instead of being your authentic self. It's sort of a formula that doesn't equal out right. It doesn't work in the social scene. But if you go into an experience where you're enjoying the experience and you see someone else enjoying that experience and you just say hi without hoping that they come over and talk with you, just because you're there and they're there, and you express that, hey, I'm just here enjoying myself. I'm not here to intrude upon you or get in your space. I'm just enjoying myself. And they're the same way, you're most likely going to bond with people like that. Just like as soon as I got into a relationship and I stopped looking, suddenly I was more attractive. Suddenly people came to me. Suddenly people wanted to be closer to me. Suddenly I was safer because I wasn't desperate, because I wasn't looking. And I started putting the pieces together. Oh, so when I'm desperate and looking, people sense it and they don't want that. They want someone who's more confident in themselves and not trying to accomplish something, not trying to be friends or anything closer. They don't want this agenda. They just want someone they can relate to or connect with without feeling like there's a string attached. And that's really the bottom line, is that when you go make friends, don't attach strings. Don't have expectations. Just say, hey, how you doing? And then keep walking. And if they say, hey, how are you? And you go, I'm great. And you start talking, perfect. If not, then keep walking. You don't put too much effort into it. Taking out the effort makes you more appealing, quite frankly, because they don't sense that neediness or that desperation. So where you go to meet people and where you have new experiences, that's a different thing altogether. You can go to meetup groups, you can go to Craigslist and find events, you can find things on Facebook, events on Facebook, you can go to things that interest you. I mean, this may not interest you, but you mentioned like you play video games. There are people that get together and play video games. Depending on who you want to meet, and if you really enjoy playing video games, you can connect with other video game players either online or in person and make friends that way. Or you could go bowling one night and just enjoy yourself and see what happens. Or even invite a colleague or two to bowl where there's just no strings attached. Like, hey, I'm going bowling tonight. You guys want to join me? Great. And if they do, great. If they don't, then you just go by yourself. You start making experiences about you, enjoying your time, enjoying yourself. And then other people are going to resonate with that and be attracted to that. When other people see that you're actually happy in you, they want that feeling too, and they're going to connect with you more and more. So that's all I'm going to say about this, Bill. Thank you so much for sharing all this. You're definitely great at small talk. I just think you don't have to be so selective about what you choose to talk about. And maybe you have a lot to say that's very personal, and you haven't found someone safe to do that with. And you ask me, can you help? And I'm saying, yes, I can. If you can't get what you need from this episode, then reach out to me. We can coach together. I'm happy to talk with you, and we'll get you to a better place where a lot of this communication stuff that was so challenging before becomes normal. I mean, you hear me on my show every week. I talk about stuff that maybe a lot of people don't. They don't want to maybe admit, or they just don't feel confident enough in themselves to get to that space where they don't mind being judged. I come on the air every week not minding that people are going to judge me, not minding that people might write about me in the news or on blogs or whatever. I know that there are going to be people that don't resonate with my message, and I do it anyway. And I found that the more vulnerable and authentic that I am, the more people reach out to me, the more people like me, the more people like the show, and the more they get from it. So give people the benefit of the doubt. Allow them to judge what you're saying and see what happens. You may be more selective while you're working with patients at work because you have to say very specific things to follow very specific guidelines for your education and what you do for a profession. But outside of work, when you can be more of yourself, give yourself the freedom to be you and open yourself up for anything that may come your way. Like you said, you're a man now. You're an adult. So if somebody doesn't like you, that's normal. You don't want every single person in the world to like you because that means you're probably faking it. If everyone in the world likes you, then you're probably faking something. I might be wrong, but not everyone likes the same things. We're all different. So we have to show them our true selves in order for them to have true feelings and thoughts about us so that we create true bonding friendships. I hope this helps. Thank you again, Bill. We'll be right back in a moment. All right, welcome back. And I want to read another letter really quick because it's a really good one. This is Ask Paul Part 2. This letter is from someone I'll call Jill. I always use Bill and Jill, just easier to remember. She says, "Hi, Paul. I stumbled onto your podcast recently and have been hooked ever since. I love your topics of discussion and insight. My question to you is this," and this is a really good question, "why do people who are truly in love cheat?" To give you some background, for many, many years, I've been happily married, and I recently cheated on my husband with someone I know. Despite being madly in love with my husband and having a great sex life, I gave into the temptation. I felt a strong sense of attraction and chemistry to the other man that I broke my vow. Afterward, I started feeling so guilty that I confessed it to my husband. We are really trying to work through it, but he keeps asking me why I did it. I really don't know why I did it, other than the obvious. I went to see a therapist, and all she kept asking me is why I confessed. Seriously? That's her words. Seriously? I truly love my husband, and I don't want to lose him, but I'm completely baffled as to why someone like me, who is madly in love with her husband, would commit such a selfish act. I would really like to know your thoughts on this subject. Thank you. All right, Jill. Thanks for that admission. Thanks for sharing that. And thanks for asking that very important question. My first answer is, I don't know. I know that's not very helpful. In fact, I received your letter a couple months back, and I reached out to you, and I'm like, hey, can I talk to you about this? Because I want to know why you did this too. And I didn't hear back, so I wanted to put it on my list to talk about it on this episode. So I had to wrap my brain around this concept. Someone who has a great sex life, loves their spouse, and still cheats. And I even watched a TED talk that really didn't tell me too much of anything. And then I asked some people about it. And this is one of those subjects that are sort of baffling at first. But then I started thinking about it. And I started thinking about it from the perspective of who I was at one time. And this was in the 90s. I was very, very loyal and dedicated to my girlfriend. And I worked with several women. And a couple of them, I was in my 20s. I was, let's just say, very attracted to. And I also believed that as long as I didn't go too far, there was no inappropriate behavior. However, I look back at my behavior back then and realized that how I treated the women I worked with could be considered sexual harassment nowadays. Yes, I hate to admit it, but I was in my 20s, which is like, for some men, 14 or 15. And I said things and did things that I am not proud of, and I made them uncomfortable. Not all of them. Some of them were very receptive to the way I talked or the way I behaved. Now, I didn't go overboard. I didn't go too far. I never cheated. But the things I said and the things I thought could be considered a borderline first step to cheating. So I think about that stuff now and I go, geez, you know, what made me be that way? How come I was so forward with the women I worked with, and how come I was treating them the way I did? Well, back then, my hormones were in charge for the most part. And when you're young and your body is working normally, your body is working the way it should work, you might have this battle between your hormones and your willpower. There might be a battle there. And for me, there was. Now, I can look back at this analytically and go, well, that's who I was, and that's how I was, and of course I did it because of XYZ. But being in that space, I remember just being infatuated, I mean, lusting for someone else, because my hormones were on fire, and I just needed to be near those people. But I remember one person in particular I made very uncomfortable. But back then, I wasn't thinking that they were uncomfortable. I was just thinking about my comfort level. I was thinking about how I wanted to be closer to them, regardless if they wanted to be close to me or not. That is infatuation, for sure. That, you know, even though I was with someone and loyal to them, I was still attracted and still motivated to be close to these other women because I felt like I was getting some innate, maybe sexual desire fulfilled. But certainly one thing came to mind is that I loved feeling like I was wanted. Not by all of them, but by a couple. I felt like I was wanted. I felt like I was desired. I felt attractive. And feeling those things made me feel sexually powerful, masculine. It made me feel like a man. But my willpower won and kept me loyal. And then as I grew older and my hormones weren't in charge anymore, then I put more time and effort and energy into my relationships, then things shifted for me and I was able to build stronger intimate relationships and make people not so uncomfortable to be around me. And certainly make things less tempting for me by being more respectful of women around me. So I've been in a situation where I felt the desire to want to be physical with other people, even though I was in love and loyal to the person I was with. And I'm going to say this right now, I think that's normal, because our body is designed to work a certain way. And when everything lines up and we resonate with someone else physically, this is going to happen. You can be in love with the best person for you in the world, and you'll still have physical desire. Not everyone. Some people don't. My girlfriend claims that she doesn't desire anyone but me. I hope that's true. But you never know. I mean, she might meet someone that has the perfect pheromone, the perfect scent, the perfect body that she really enjoys. Maybe she'll meet someone like me. Who knows? And maybe that desire will come over her. And then she'll be like, whoa. I talk about it, hoping it doesn't happen. But I'm a realist. We have physical bodies with people that have compatible physical bodies. And there are going to be things that we really enjoy. Smells, visuals. And especially if we're in close proximity and you combine that with a feeling of being wanted, being attractive to someone else, all these things combine to create the perfect reproductive environment, the most analytical way to look at it. It's the perfect storm of all the variables to present an opportunity to take or not to take. And what causes you to take it from that point on sometimes can be pure willpower. So, why does it happen? Why does someone who's so in love and already has a great sex life, why would that happen to someone? I think it's because our chemical nature, our physical nature, and we're born to reproduce creates attractions that are sometimes very hard to control. That's not an excuse. I'm not saying that because of that, you are allowed to do it. It really depends on your level of willpower and what is most important to you overall. Now, here's the thing. You can have a bigger vision for your relationship going, I would never cheat on my spouse and I'll always be happy. And I'm always going to put time and energy into my relationship with my spouse because that's what I want to grow and keep growing so that we become closer and closer all the time. All those intentions could be in there. But when there are unmet needs, then the willpower tends to be lacking. So this is why I wanted to talk to this letter writer, Jill, because I wanted to know what possible unmet needs they could have been. Because if you have a completely satisfying relationship in every way, then what's left over where you want more? You might say, well, variety. I've been with this person for a long time and I don't remember what it's like to be with someone else. Or maybe I've never experienced what it's like to be with someone else. So I want variety. All right, that could be true. But are you willing to accept that you may not get that variety unless you talk to your partner about it? Now here's a little twist. Because you could say, you know, I love our sex life, but I would like something more. That doesn't necessarily mean I want to go outside of our relationship. I just want something different. And that could mean I want my husband to dress up in a French maid outfit and walk in the room, and then it'll be something different. Or I want to pretend that we're at the office and then something happens. You know, this is role playing. It sounds silly, but, you know, it could work. But it's a lot better than risking a great relationship. But it could work. That's just one practical idea that you could implement, is to talk to your partner or your spouse, your boyfriend, girlfriend, about anything that may be lacking. Because you can have the greatest thing ever and still lack something. So Jill, when you think about this person that you connected with, what did this person offer that your husband didn't or couldn't? And I'm not just talking about sex. I'm talking about anything. Anything in the entire spectrum of male companionship. What did this person offer that you weren't getting from your husband? I can almost guarantee that there's something, even small, that's in there. So just think of anything that this person offered that your husband didn't. And then you'll have a starting point on why you might have done this. So obviously this is going to be very personal to you, and I may not have pinpointed why you did it specifically, but I can understand how it can happen. And if the craving or the infatuation or the attraction is so strong that you really feel like there's going to be some sort of physical connection with the person and it will lead to cheating, then either A, you get in control of yourself and control that willpower and make it happen no matter what, or B, you may have to get out of the situation, or C, you give in and risk your marriage. The hard part is overcoming sexual urges with willpower. That's extremely difficult for some people. Extremely difficult for some people. Still no excuse, because it can be done. If you really wanted to do this, you can do it. But something allowed it to happen. Something in lack. And that thing in lack needs to be discussed before you fall into the arms of someone else. I'm not judging what you did. You're going to do that to yourself for who knows how long. You're going to be talking about it with your husband for who knows how long. And I hope you guys can work it out, because someone who's remorseful typically will not cheat again. And I hope that's you. I mean, if this is what you want for your relationship and you want to keep it going, I hope that you, the remorseful person, the one who admits it, the one who just can't stand living with the secret, is typically the one who doesn't do it again. It's the ones that we catch, that we have to pry out of them that they cheated, that are usually the ones that either have done it more than once or are capable of easily lying to you and doing it again and maybe again and maybe again, unfortunately. So your relationship has a great chance of getting through this if you're both strong enough to do it. And if anyone's listening now thinking, you know, I have these urges, I might be attracted to someone or I am attracted to someone and I'm contemplating it, I want you to think of, what about that kind of connection with someone else? What about that connection are you not receiving elsewhere? What about it is so compelling that you might be willing to risk your relationship? And when you know what it is, talk about it with your partner. I know it might be hard, it might be hurtful, but talk about it. I'm not saying that you're thinking about cheating, but you can say, I really want this in this relationship. I really want this in our sex life, and I'm not getting it. So I'm having thoughts of what it might be like. Again, you don't have to say you're thinking about cheating unless you want to, but I'm sure that conversation will blossom as it needs to. But the less you talk about it, the more compelling it will be. You know, it's funny. I don't think I've ever mentioned this on the air. When I was married, I met this girl that I worked with in a hotel room because she was coming up for a few days, and we were just friends. And so I met her. We went to the bar and had a couple drinks. I mean, it already sounds terrible. We went back to her hotel room, but it really was completely innocent. However, while I was there, something was happening inside of me. I felt funny, and I felt like this might go badly if I stay. And suddenly I realized, oh my God, I'm attracted to this person. I don't know if this is safe. I really felt and thought this. I don't know if it's safe if I stay here. I'm in a hotel room with this attractive person, and now I have alcohol in me. This is not good. And she was not trying to come on to me or anything, but I felt it inside of me. And so I decided to leave. And this is one of those options. You can try to fight your willpower, or you can just leave. I mean, if you really don't want to do this thing, then you might have to take yourself out of the equation. And that's what I did. I left. I'm like, I have to go. And she's like, what? Where are you going? I was like, I said, you know, it was great seeing you again, but I can't stay anymore. I got to go. And she's like, huh? What? And I left. And we hadn't talked since because I felt so weird that I, A, had to leave, B, that I had an attraction to her and I didn't want to sit there fighting the attraction and then risk my marriage. So I left. And I was thinking, you know, my marriage wasn't perfect, but I wanted to preserve what it was and make it better. And I didn't want to be in a situation like that. I removed myself from temptation. That doesn't mean I'm a great guy and perhaps I should have planned better, but I didn't know it until we were together in a room alone. I'm thinking, I can't be here. I can't do this. I can't be in this room with you. I mean, these are thoughts going through my head, and risk what I've created with my wife. This is not going to happen. And in her mind, she's probably thinking, what's not going to happen? I mean, like I said, I didn't share this with her, but I have a feeling that she had no plans on doing anything like that. But for some reason, my body was starting to activate because I'm a normal human male. And my brain said, you need to leave because you are getting activated here. This is not good for your relationship. And I said, you're right. Let's get the heck out of here. My bigger vision was to keep my current relationship with my wife, was to continue expanding and growing that relationship. And I had to come to a comfortable place inside of me saying, well, my body was doing what it does when it's attracted to another person. It's hard to admit that, but I think this happens to almost everyone. I think every single one of us have been so attracted to someone else, even when we're with someone else, that we have to make a choice. We have to take steps. And sometimes we have to make decisions that we're not going to be that person that betrays the person we're with. And is our willingness to not betray more stronger than our desire to betray, our desire to cheat. Which one wins? And if you know which one will win, that has a chance of ruining the relationship, then take yourself out of the equation. So there's my vulnerable story. It will end up in all the tabloids. Hopefully not, but I hope this answers your question, Jill. Our bodies are designed to react to compatibility, to pheromones, to different hairstyles and hair color, and the way someone looks at us, and the way someone moves, and the way someone talks to us. These are intrinsic, unconscious programs that are running that, I hate to say, we may not have full control over, but we do have control over the choices that we make. And if we're going to stay in a situation that we know might be too tempting to resist, and if it is, that's when you really need to step up and go, oh no, I'm not going to risk my relationship. Or, you know, I'm not going to tell you not to. I just think it's a better thing to go home and share with your partner what you think might be lacking or what you want more of, so that when you're in situations where there is an attraction, that it won't be so powerful that you take steps towards infidelity. Hopefully this helps. Thank you so much for writing in. And certainly reach out, Jill, if you want to talk about this more. I would really love to find out if you did find something lacking in your relationship, anything at all. So thank you again. And thanks for tuning in. We're going to end the show. I'm going to read some credits and then give you my final thoughts after this. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Overwhelmed Brain. I want you to check out getoutofthemess.com. Asha is an independent representative for Legal Shield, so if you're interested in that service, just give her a call, 678-355-8777, or go to getoutofthemess.com and get peace of mind today. If you're in the US or Canada, you can call an attorney to ask almost any question, anytime, for almost any reason. Asha will connect you with the freedom to be comfortable no matter what life sends your way. Call her today. And I want to mention the TOB Patron Program, where you can hear private episodes, get the latest workbooks and worksheets that you won't find on the regular Overwhelmed Brain website, group coaching calls, and something I just started, which is going to be a regular hangout every, 6 weeks or so, where all members of the Patron Program can hang out with me and ask me questions or just chit-chat. Whatever you want to do, I'm looking forward to connecting with a bunch of members in a couple of weeks. So if you're part of the program, I can't wait to connect with you there. And if you're not part of the program, think about joining. Go to patron.theoverwhelmedbrain.com and maybe we'll see each other on the inside. And whether you're a patron or not, I want to thank you if you've purchased one of my books or worksheets or used the Amazon link on theoverwhelmedbrain.com. Now, the Amazon link is the easiest way to give back. So if you've been listening for months, years, centuries, use that Amazon link every time you shop. Your shopping habits are making a difference, so thank you. And I'm going to go off on a limb here and thank a few Reddit users. Have you ever heard of Reddit? It's reddit.com. It's kind of like a forum where anything goes. You can talk about anything. And the following Reddit users have mentioned the Overwhelmed Brain in their posts, and I just want to thank them for that. And here they are, hopefully pronouncing it correctly, Bababy, Kitty Fever, Set Hot, or Seth Ott, Not Another Hipster, Spectre 55, The Humble Guy, and Amplitude. Those are the Reddit users that have mentioned this show, and I want to thank them so much. Thank you for recommending this show to other Reddit users that are looking for some sort of guidance in their life. I appreciate you. And finally, thank you to Kevin McLeod of Incompetech.com for some of the music transitions in The Overwhelmed Brain. All right, we're at the end of episode number 150. All that means is that when I started this show in November of 2013, I started counting episode numbers. Like I said, every 50 episodes was like a milestone. Like, all right, I've done it. I've done another 50. That's almost a year of episodes. So now we're at 3 years full of episodes, and there's no sign of stopping. So If you've been listening since episode one, and I know quite a few of you have actually, thank you. And wow, you have a lot of time on your hands. Of course, it's only an hour a week or sometimes an hour and a half, but I do thank you and I appreciate you. And if you just started listening, I thank you too. No matter where you are in the spectrum of listening to this show, I appreciate you. And I especially want you to improve your life if you need it. I think most people listen to improve something in their life. There's something, like we were talking about in the last segment, there's something lacking. Or if it's not lack, it's just the way we feel, the way we think. Maybe our inner dialogue has control over us and we keep thinking these critical thoughts about ourselves or about other people. And we just want to get beyond this. Maybe we want to get beyond sadness or depression or something that's going on in our life that we just can't seem to get past. We can't seem to get beyond. And over the years of doing this show, I've had to really think about what my mission is here. Only in this past year did I come to a conclusion of like a philosophy of what this show is really about, what my coaching is all about, and everything I write about, everything I talk about. And it's to get you to a place of empowerment. It's to get you to a place where you're making decisions that are right for you. And I'll tell you what, when you make decisions that are right for you, it's right for everyone. Because when you improve yourself, those who love and support you want that for you, which makes them happier. It might be a weird way to look at it, but if you choose to look at it that way, then what's stopping you from improving yourself? What typically stops us from improving ourselves is the thought that someone won't like us improving or changing ourselves. Now, isn't that interesting? Who do you keep in your life that doesn't want you to improve yourself? I mean, that's an important question. If you can answer that, and you probably can, if you can come up with an answer for that, then how is that person helpful in your life? If someone doesn't support you or even puts you down for trying to become a better person inside yourself, then how are they benefiting you in your life? That might be hard to think about because some people like that we've married. Some people we can't get rid of because maybe they live close to us or their family, you know, our mom or dad, or maybe there's someone that they're just in our circles, or, you know, whatever. Who is it in your life, or who are they in your life, that don't support you and want you to become a better person? You know, when somebody doesn't want you to become a better person, it's because they themselves don't want to change. And if you change, that will force them to change, because in order to communicate with you, they have to communicate with you from a different place. Not always, but typically that's what happens, is that you'll get to a place where you feel better. But when you felt bad, it was easier for them to communicate with you. It was easier for them to relate to you feeling bad, whether that's because they feel bad themselves and it makes them feel better to be with someone who feels bad as well, even though you still end up feeling bad most of the time, or because of some other reason. But when someone doesn't want you to change, it's because of something in them that doesn't want change in themselves. Because changing means growing, means getting out of a comfort zone, comfortable being uncomfortable. If that's presented to some people, they might not be ready for change. They might not be ready to be happier. I want you to be ready to be happier. I want you to be willing to take steps into a better life for yourself, even if other people aren't going to take the ride with you. I'm telling you, those who love and support you want you to do this for yourself. And when you have people like that in your life that want you to do things for yourself, you're more likely going to keep those people in your life because they're supporting you. But those who don't want you to change fear that you're going to grow beyond and evolve beyond your relationship with them. So they want to keep you where you are. If you grow, if you get better, you're not going to love me anymore. Ouch, there's some dysfunction being thrown your way. So it's stopping you from evolving or healing or whatever it takes to make a better life for yourself. So they're really shooting themselves in the foot when they don't support you wanting to get better. And at the same time, it's possible that you could leave these people in your life. You could leave them behind. And it's still the best thing for everyone. Because sometimes you're in someone's life feeding their dysfunction. Your dysfunction feeds their dysfunction. You complement each other. So someone has to make a change to get out of the dysfunction. And although, yes, it could hurt the other person's feelings, they have an opportunity to get help themselves or heal themselves or take steps so that they can get better in some way. But by staying in the relationship and keeping the dysfunction alive, neither one of you changes. And that's not always pleasant, unless you like that relationship the way it is. But typically a lot of dysfunction in a relationship is not pleasant. It's not happy. And I want you to be happy. And the first step is into your power. You know what I say, open your mind, step into your power, and be firm in your decisions and actions so that you can create the life you want. That's assertion. Be assertive. Always take steps to grow and evolve. You're powerful beyond measure. And above all, and this is something I absolutely know to be true about you, you are amazing.